Hey, hey, everybody. Welcome back, athletes and non-athletes, to another episode of Live Like an Athlete. Thank you for joining us again. I'm your host, Erin Sharoni. I'm missing my partner in crime again, Big Herc, but that's okay. I'm getting used to handling it on my own, if you're listening, Herc. I know you guys probably miss him. He will be back next time, fear not. So it's just me and you and our guest today. We've got a great show for you, something a little bit different. And I figured with all the craziness going on in the NBA and NHL playoffs this season, you know, you got emotions flying high on the courts, on the ice, and the stands among the fans, obviously. I thought it would be a good time to take a look at the effect of emotion itself on the game, because we haven't talked about that yet on this show. And obviously, I'm talking about sports psychology. So the mental game is just as important, if not more important, than the physical game. Any athlete would tell you that. You can be in perfect condition, but if your brain isn't connected, if your emotions are out of control, that elite conditioning really doesn't do you very much good. So to that end, I figured who better to address this than someone who's practiced in psychology. And we've got an amazing guest joining us today who doesn't actually reside entirely in the sports world. And in fact, I know her from my former days working on the trading floor on Wall Street. Her name is Denise Schull, and she's a performance consultant who specializes actually in trading psychology, because yes, traders need as much performance help as athletes or anybody else. And she's also worked with professional sports stars and their coaches applying the same techniques. So before we bring her on in just a sec, I've just got to read our usual disclaimer since we are talking about medical stuff. I want to remind everybody listening that in no way should this be considered as medical advice, a substitute for a professional opinion, etc. This is for your personal entertainment and edification only. Please advise a physician before beginning any exercise program or making any changes to your diet. So now that that's out of the way, I'll just give you some quick background on our guest, Denise Schull. She's a performance consultant and a thought leader in risk psychology. She founded the Rethink Group in 2003 in order to solve the vexing problem of human misperception of risk. Today, Schull's taught thousands of Wall Street professionals how to avoid their typical behavioral responses to fear and greed. She specializes in separating intuition, felt knowledge, from impulse. And obviously, because this applies to sports performance as well as financial performance, she's also worked with golfers, NFL players, and British professional footballers and their coaches and GMs applying the same principles. Her trading career began with equities in 1994 at the Chicago Board of Options Exchange. She later traded futures as a member of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And it was then that she began transforming neuroeconomics, the new science of the brain on risk, into investing profits. She's got a great book called Market Mind Games, A Radical Psychology of Investing, Trading, and Risk, which has been described as the best of its genre. She graduated from Harvard's Kennedy School Executive Program, and she holds a Master of Arts in Neuroscience from the University of Chicago. So she's clearly very accomplished and very well qualified to join us. With that, I welcome her on. Denise, it's so great to have you here.
Thank you, Erin. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's obviously I mentioned I knew you from my 6 years on Wall Street prior to sports television, so it's cool that we are reconnecting in a different context today.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the sports trading parallel, they're basically both performance disciplines. So the principles really do apply in both arenas.
Exactly, which is why I was so excited. As soon as I started this podcast, I had written you down as a potential guest, because I said, she's the woman who I want to talk to about, the psychology behind performance, which we haven't spoken about yet. We've had a neurologist on talking about the brain and concussions, but we haven't really spoken about performance. So to that end, Denise, why don't you start us off by explaining to us exactly what it is that you do and how it's applicable to sports performance?
Well, what I do is take actually the latest research about how the brain uses emotion in motivation, performance, recovery, and apply that to people who are in high stress situations. I translate what the research means in, you know, sort of day-to-day terms, and then how can someone say, okay, if this is what we've learned about emotion and the brain and, you know, my own psychological experience, whether I'm playing a sport or whether I'm trading in the market, what can I do with that research? So the core of it is that the view at the cutting edge of neuroscience or neuroeconomics, which is simply just the brain on risk, the core is that emotions are actually critical, foundational. You have to have them. You need them for survival. They're supposed to do all these good things for you. But they've been misperceived, you know, basically since the time of the Greeks. So the models that people have been working on, whether it's in sports psychology or trading psychology, are at this point out of date. And in short, I'm trying to bring them up to date and make them practical.
And I think that's a really interesting point that you mentioned about emotions sort of being misperceived over time, really for quite a long time, especially when you think about generally male-dominated industries like the trading floor on Wall Street, like you know, a professional sports arena. Obviously, there are women in professional sports as well. But if we're talking about NBA and NHL playoffs right now, those are male sports. And so there is that sort of, at least in our culture, that gender bias where, you know, it's in the past, at least, it's been, hey, you're supposed to stuff your emotions back in. Don't show your emotions. Don't show your hand. Keep a poker face. And we know that that gets traders into all sorts of trouble, and I would presume the same goes for athletes.
Absolutely. And actually, I'm glad you brought up this point, because I just read some new research related to gender and emotion, and it specifically looked at, you know, does a male versus a female experience, you know, more or less emotion, with the expectation that somehow men were actually going to experience less, like literally as you watched their brain and watched circuits that are associated with emotion. And in fact, they found that no, men and women experienced, you know, inside themselves the same amount of emotion, or at least their brain showed, you know, effectively markers of the same amount of emotion. But the emotion in men was more outer directed. So, like, I think that actually relates to being in team sports, and emotion in women was more inner-directed, but the same quantity, just directionally different. So that applies in risk management and on Wall Street, but I think it might ultimately have something to say even about athletes and, you know, male versus female athletes and team sports versus traditionally male team sports versus maybe individual sports and traditionally individual female sports like maybe skiing or golf.
Sure. Well, that's a difference of, it sort of seems to be the difference of experience versus expression. There's an equal experience, but what's expressed may be different, or at least even what's perceived may be different because of conditioning, right?
Correct. You couldn't be more correct in that, you know, it is more conditioned generally out of males. And in fact, the sports arena tends to, you know, developmentally from when we're all small children, be a big piece of that, you know.
You know, Denise, this is actually brings me to a point that you sent me in your notes, which was very interesting. And you said, emotion is a fundamental data point in the brain and therefore needs to be treated with respect. When a coach tells a player to just get over it, that can often make the situation worse. Dealing with the negative emotions in the, quote, old way exacerbates negative momentum shifts, losing streaks, slumps, self-destruction, and self-sabotage. All that is really interesting in the context of what we just mentioned. So can you address that?
Sure. So traditionally, emotions considered to be, you know, sort of unhelpful, even though it's such a big part of sports in terms of motivation. But negative emotions are considered to be unhelpful. Well, from the brain point of view, you know, the brain's looking out for you, really. And if you have a negative emotion, if you're upset about something, you know, upset about a performance, upset about a missed shot, the reason that negative emotion really exists is to help you be motivated to figure out how to fix the situation. And so the brain's using it like in the bigger picture of your overall development, that the discomfort feeling or the uncomfortable feeling, the unpleasant feeling, is meant to turn your attention to something that you need to work on, like, why did I miss that shot? So what happens when we're told to set the emotion aside or get over it, the brain feels like, and we try to do that and we try to focus on other things, the signal that we need to pay attention to is actually still there. And so what happens is the energy of that feeling from the first missed shot, we'll say, goes into what goes out and happens to the player. Oftentimes they miss the next shot, right? That is really the negative energy, or the energy associated with the negative feeling from the first missed shot. So what happens if you take an alternative approach and you say, yeah, you know, feel like crap for a minute because you missed a shot, as opposed to get over it, it allows your brain to feel that you consciously got the message, that that's something you need to work on. And once the brain recognizes that you consciously got the message and you're allowed to feel the negative feeling and preferably actually put it into words, then it goes away and you don't, the energy of it doesn't have to be reenacted in the next play.
That's really interesting, because something that we often hear, you know, just a spectator, a viewer, will often hear a player or a coach say after a game in which, for instance, they lost, right? So take the playoffs,
right.
You've got high stakes. And their answer is almost always the same, which is, yeah, well, we're just looking ahead to the next game. Now, that may be partly because they don't want to have that conversation with whatever media person is harassing them with a microphone in the locker room after they just blew a game. But by the same token, you hear athletes say that a lot in the professional sports world, at least publicly. Yeah, we lost, but we don't think about that now. We just look ahead to the next game. So what's that about? Because that seems on the surface sort of contradictory to what you're saying.
Well, that stems from the traditional belief that you need to just set negative emotions aside and go forward. It stems from the traditional belief that your thinking is the most important psychological resource you have, when in fact your feelings are the most important psychological resource you have. And so the commonality of we're just looking forward to the next game just stems from this old cognitive behavioral, very few people would call it old, but I call it old because of the current research I don't think supports that the brain is thinking and doing. The brain is feeling, thinking, and doing. And I could bore you for the next 4 days straight with research proving that. But it's not known yet in the general fields of performance psychology. And it's certainly not, even if it's known, there'll be a little lip service to it, but it's not translated into practicality. So like, there's research showing that if people have a fear, their absolute best strategy is to let themselves feel that fear in all its glory. And if they do that and they put words to it, I mean, just take something like fear of spiders. There's actually a research study out of UCLA with this, and it's actually fear of a tarantula. And the people who were like the most fearful and said, oh my gosh, I'm terrified of this tarantula, were able to actually go sit next to the tarantula and touch it. Where every other strategy, the tarantula isn't poisonous, the tarantula won't bite me, every other strategy was way inferior in terms of what the person was able to do, what they were able to execute in their behavior. So in sports, like, the best thing people could do when they have a losing game is let everybody be upset about it. Let them be upset about it overnight. What's it? It's not going to hurt. It's actually going to help, because it is essentially you're working it out for yourself and you're getting your brain's message.
I'm so glad that you brought up that topic of fear, because actually, you read my mind, because that was my next on my question list. But that was a great segue. And I really wanted to address the topic of fear, the emotion of fear, because I think, it's like you said, there's a lot of maybe old or traditional thinking, especially within the pro sports world, where, to embrace fear may not be the coolest thing in the world. And yet, I don't care who you are, you're going to have some amount of fear, whether it's fear of failure, whether it's fear of an opponent who's going to guard you, whether it's fear of getting hurt. I'm quite certain that that exists because it's a natural human response. And to that end, I was looking across your website, and you wrote a really great post that I found the other day, and the title is Fear, Affect, Emotion, and Psychological Science. And I thought it was brilliant, and I'm going to quote you because you said, "Forms of fear permeate the process of trading. Every market decision bets on a fundamentally unknowable future, and as such, trading implicitly includes a factor derived from the spectrum of panic to overconfidence. Moment to moment, a trader's beliefs can ameliorate debilitating or palpable fear." Aside from the fact that I thought that was a really incredible insight, it's really applicable to pro sports, especially in the context of playoffs, where you have these high stakes. Fear is a very real thing, and it's a real-time decision. It's play-by-play, just like in the market. Trading is also play-by-play. The market is dynamic. The basketball court is dynamic. The ice is dynamic. Things are constantly changing. You have constant variables. You have a lot of different players. There's a lot of risk. There's a lot of strategy. There's a lot of reading your opponent, regardless of whether you're a trader or an athlete. And so that particular quote, I thought, was just so profound, particularly where you said the fundamentally unknowable future. And that's what people are terrified of, ultimately, right?
Well, that's certainly what they're terrified of in the markets, and, you know, to a lesser degree, probably in sports. But nevertheless, I will say that the tactic, you know, direct from the research, like the single best thing any team in the playoffs right now could do is choose to handle the feeling of fear or doubt differently. And so when someone's walking up to the free throw line, instead of saying, okay, you know, I'm going to block everybody out, or I'm, you know, I'm going to focus on the rim, or, you know, whatever their techniques are, they're going to visualize. I can guarantee you the single most effective thing they could do is say, I'm nervous. If they let themselves actually, you know, as they're walking over to the line and then they're dribbling a little bit, actually say, I'm nervous. What's going to happen is that energy is basically going to be expended, and their you know, hard practice, long practiced ability to make that shot will then be able to come through.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
You need, you know, in my opinion, obviously you need at least a coach and probably a general manager and a coach to adopt this new viewpoint of fear, because they've all been trained and in the, you know, sort of old method of try to set it aside and, you know, focus on the fact that you are, you know, 68% free throw shooter, or you know, 72% free throw shooter, so therefore your odds are good. That's using the cognitive.
That's really interesting, because I think that would be almost anyone's default position, is to say, all right, you know, just remember you're really good at what you do. Of course, in the context of high stakes trading or in the context of the playoffs, everybody is really good at what they do. Despite what fans may yell about a certain player, they're all really good at what they do, or they wouldn't be there. Some are better at some things than others, but, you know, in the context of things, you're all really good. So it's interesting, because I think that would certainly be anybody's default reply is, well, come on, man, get your act together. You know that you shoot 70% from the free throw line. How could you possibly miss?
Right.
So it's interesting to think of that sort of paradox.
Right. Which... I've used this tactic of, you know, verbalize your fears and doubts and anxieties with traders. I mean, I have clients that are running trading desks for organizations everyone that's listening to this know of, and I've taught them to do this real time, and to a person, they all report that it works. They're all amazed. You know, I was like really nervous about this trade, but I just did what you said. I just decided to talk to myself about feeling nervous or feeling, and then I executed really well. Like, and I could see what was happening in the market, and I made some really good decisions, and it was a completely different, you know, psychological experience. I felt completely different. My anxiety went down. And that's one of the things, like, anyone listening to this, try this. I mean, try it, you know, in your own sports, when you're putting, or, you know, whatever sport you're playing, to just say, I'm nervous about this, and see what happens. You'll be astonished, actually, what allowing yourself to actually experience whatever, you know, point on that spectrum you're at, from panic to overconfidence. And it does, oh, by the way, apply to the other side when you're winning and you get too overconfident, or, you know, and then things fall apart. It's the same thing. If you actually experience the joy of that, you wouldn't get overconfident and then, you know, let things fall apart.
Yeah, and that actually was another one of my questions, which we'll come back to. You're answering all of my questions without my even asking them, Denise. It's amazing. No, it's great. But I want to bring in a listener question. Somebody on Twitter, at Eric Schumann, says, the Kings have struggled against the Hawks for some time now. Are their problems more mental than anything else? And for anyone who's not up to speed, that's hockey, and they are both in the Western Conference Finals. And so when he says, are their problems more mental than anything else? Well, obviously, you know, there's physical conditioning, and Denise is not a hockey analyst. However, in light of what you just said, Denise, if a team has been struggling against another team for, as Eric says, some time now, it, you know, is part of that process the momentum of kind of repressing, could it be part of this repressing the emotions, or using that old paradigm, cognitive psychology paradigm that you mentioned, could that be getting them into trouble? Because we know that on a physical level, there's only so much you can change in a short window of time. But on a mental level, you can change things fairly quickly.
Correct. Well, there has to be a mental component. I mean, first of all, just because there always is a mental component, but when you're in a situation where you're either in a losing streak or in this situation consistently losing to a team, then, you know, you start to have an expectation that for, you know, one reason or another, you're cursed against this team, you know, or you're jinxed. And the feeling is like, no matter what we do, you know, we can't beat them. And maybe on paper, I don't know enough about hockey to say this, but it wouldn't surprise me on paper if the team that's, you know, consistently losing is actually slightly better than the other team. It wouldn't surprise me a bit. But it creates a belief, and the belief then basically gets acted out because there isn't the proper strategy to interrupt the belief.
And, you know, a great example of that is actually in the other conference series, in the Eastern Conference series, over in the NHL, and, you know, we just mentioned the Kings Blackhawks, but the Rangers Canadiens series, the Rangers are leading two games in the series. And for anyone who's listening, we're taping this on a Tuesday morning, so by the time you hear this, things could have changed, but as of Tuesday morning, the Rangers are leading the Canadiens 2-0, and both of those games have been at Montreal's home at the Bell Center. And it's interesting you mention what you just mentioned, Denise, because for years, actually, the Rangers superstar goalie Henrik Lundqvist, I'm sure you know who he is because you live in New York City, so you can't escape
right.
It, has really struggled there. And you mentioned, you know, someone thinking they're cursed. And I don't know if that's what he thought, but he was a disaster. He couldn't win at the Bell Center at all. I mean, for, I don't know what the exact number is. I don't have it in front of me, but for however many games, I mean, he was really quite a long time. And everyone said, oh God, now they're going to face these guys in the Eastern Conference Finals. And, you know, Lundqvist is this incredible goalie who's going to fall apart simply because he's up at the Bell Center in Montreal. And in fact, he has played unbelievably as of right now in the series. He's only allowed three goals on 63 shots, which is pretty...
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive.
Wow. Well, I actually just read some research just to support this, and it was specifically on mental toughness. But what they found was mental toughness in and of itself did not correlate with actually the ability to learn or the ability to perform. But they tested then for sort of subsets of elements within mental toughness. And so one of the subsets is self-belief. And it turned out that self-belief was actually the most predictive of performance. So where people would, you know, the cognitive behavior model sort of, you know, in sports terms, you could call it mental toughness, you know, like for a shorthand. But it's really within that, what is one believing about themselves? And so there, you know, when you lose to a person or a team over a period of time, you know, of course, just in trying to understand how it's happening, you come up with explanations, and those explanations then morph into beliefs and then those beliefs influence how you can perform, and all the while you're never really dealing with the disappointment or the fear, or you're dealing with the disappointment and the fear in the wrong way, so it's actually getting bigger and further impacting your performance, and you're going to lose to them again.
That's really interesting, with the emphasis being on what is one believing about themselves, because I don't think many people ask themselves that question, just because it's not necessarily a question that would come up unless you have some high stakes on the table. But I'm not so sure that everyone actually believes about themselves what they think on a superficial level they believe, you know, because
right.
any great athlete is, by default, his answer is going to be, well, yeah, I'm the best. Because if he didn't
right.
say that, or he didn't sort of think that, then he or she probably wouldn't be where they are. But if you dig deeper, or you're honest with yourself, what is it that you really believe? Or you might believe you're the best at some component of your game, right, but not every component of your game. Or you might believe you're the best with condition. So I'm the best as long as I'm not playing in Montreal, or something like that.
Right. And then what's happening is your coaches are telling you to believe in yourself. And so the part where you don't believe in yourself, or the part you're worried about, just gets further obscured. It never gets addressed. And addressed is what needs to happen. The parts that you don't believe need to come to the surface. And sort of everyone needs to get less afraid of admitting that they're insecure about this element of their game. Because it, literally the admitting that they don't feel as confident in this element of the game is going to make them play better in that element of the game.
That's really interesting. And then, Denise, just taking a look at the flip side, you touched on it briefly before, you know, the hubris or the confidence level. Sometimes individual players, we see this all the time, or even whole teams become too comfortable with, for instance, a wide margin in the score, right? We see this happen all the time where a team
right.
comes out strong and then for whatever reason, whether it's cockiness, overconfidence, whether it's laziness, I mean, there's a number of different factors, but just from a performance and emotional perspective, what's generally going on there when something like that happens? When you say, oh my God, this team had a 30-point margin and then they just puked all over themselves. They just gave it all up, you know, and the fans are furious.
Right.
Or we see this with certain players too.
Right.
You know, and I won't name any in particular, but maybe you can address that.
Okay, I'll try not to name any in particular either, because in the basketball world, I can name a few.
No, go but, right ahead. You can. I'm not going to, though.
Well, we'll start with that. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, originally, so we won't necessarily name any names at the moment.
But,
So you start with the emotional backdrop of you're feeling really confident that you can beat this team. And so that influences your preparation. You maybe, you know, aren't quite as focused as you would be because this is kind of a layup, you know, to sort of mix metaphors there. And then you go out, and the other team, in fact, has prepared really well because they want to beat you because they didn't beat you the last time and they don't feel like they can beat you. So they're very focused, and it means more to them, and they're essentially more motivated. Or, you know, let's just take, they're up, you know, team one's up by 30 at halftime and, you know, the same thing happens, you know, at halftime. So the down team starts to perform better. And then the team that was up or was supposed to win is in this mental state where they can't shift. They can't shift in real time to, oh, you know, this is a completely different situation and we need to be handling it different. The first thing that happens is they just get frustrated and annoyed. You know, we weren't supposed to be losing to this team, or we weren't supposed to be losing now because we were up by 30, and they're frustrated and they're mad at themselves and they can't understand how it's happening. And then what are they told to do with their frustration being mad at themselves? Stuff it and get back out there and, you know, get the score. Well, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So because if they could go, you know, if they could go to the sidelines and have a conversation, a timeout that was about simply about how frustrated we are that we let this happen, nothing else. Don't change the game plan. Don't change who's the ball going to be passed to. Just get in there and be frustrated. They could come back out and pick their score back up.
You know, this brings us to actually a very interesting point, which I didn't even have in my notes, but as you're talking, it just occurred to me, which is like technical fouls, you know, and the increasing restrictions that we see placed on emotional outbursts. This happened in the NBA last year. It was an issue. We see it, you know, players. It seems to me that there's increasing restrictions against displays of whatever it may be, anger. And
right.
Understandably, you know, you cannot hit another player if it's not hockey. And you cannot lash out at
right.
a fan in the stands, and you're not supposed to,
right.
you know, lob the basketball at the fan's face or whatever has happened in the past. We hear about this a couple times a season every year. You know, in soccer, you have flopping and all sorts of stuff like that. So maybe, I don't know, what are your thoughts on that? Because in that sense, assuming that you're not knocking anyone in the face with your elbow or something like that, for which you should be taken out of the game. But if you're just verbalizing your anger, your emotion, and you're saying that in the context of your method, this is an appropriate way to deal with, you know, coming back from behind or with poor performance, then what are you supposed to do as a player or a coach? Is it, you know, coaches get tossed from the games all the time for showing their frustration, so to speak.
Well, but what's actually happening is because they can't show it in a, I'm searching for the word because it's not normal, it's not calm. They have to set it aside, try to control it for so long that then it explodes in a way that's extreme, and you know, then they get tossed. Where if they could just say, I'm so mad this is happening to us. I'm so mad I missed that shot. I'm so frustrated about this, which, you know, in and of itself is relatively benign, right? Then it wouldn't end up in this explosive, you know, screaming in the ref's face, you know, which you're going to get thrown out of the game. So it's a matter of if the leagues could make it acceptable to say, you know, I'm furious with this. Actually, the level of play would go up, and the level of technical fouls and people being thrown out of the game would go down.
Yeah, I mean, you do see, actually a lot, if you think about it, a lot of the really great players, if they miss a shot, they'll wince or they'll shake their head as they're running back across the court, or they'll, you know, I mean, you do see it on their faces if you watch closely. If a goalie, you know, lets in a shot, he'll usually hang his head or he'll shake his head or whatever. They're clearly disappointed with themselves. So in that sense, I guess they are expressing their own frustration. But
right. And if I'm sorry,
no, go ahead.
But it would be really interesting to do a study of players who you saw, you know, make those physical demonstrations of a negative feeling versus those you never saw it out of. And what really, how they compare over time. I'm almost sure that the ones that you see, well, it's hard because there's a possibility that the ones that you see actually, you know, in the aggregate overall sports might actually perform better than the ones who show nothing. An actual example from another sport, I think, is Tiger Woods. So, you know, before his personal meltdown, he was very demonstrative with what he felt.
Oh, you're
right. After his personal meltdown, you know, he was told he couldn't be. He hired a very cognitive coach, I happen to know, and you didn't see him show the same sort of frustration, and he struggled and struggled and struggled.
What an interesting example. I didn't even think about that till now, but that's a really interesting way to look at it. So. Maybe you have a new study coming up then. Watching the NBA playoffs and noting who winces and who doesn't, if there's a correlative effect with their performance.
You know what there is? Here, just to give you a really interesting one to make sure I don't forget it. There is a study that shows teams with more high fives win more games.
That was my next point, Denise.
Oh, I guess I am reading your mind. But there, if you think about that, why, you know, like what's really, you know, the people who did the research are like, well, why is this? How can this be? And I'm looking at it and we're going, well, it's like really obvious, you know, they feel more connected to each other. They feel, you know, like they're in this together. They are showing each other, you know, support, and they're showing each other, you know, like it's okay when something you screw something up. I mean, they're really, it demonstrates their, essentially, it demonstrates their emotional intimacy with each other and their emotional position as a group. And then when they're all in the same emotional position as a group and they're playing for the group, then, of course, they're going to win more games.
Mm. Yeah, I thought that was a really, really interesting point. I know you sent that over in your notes. And it's sort of, I mean, I feel like on a very intuitive level, it makes a whole lot of sense. But as you start to explain it, I also feel like some folks might say, oh, that's so touchy-feely. We're all in it together. But you are. It's a team sport. So you're right. The more energetically connected you are to your teammates. And you hear this all the time, in fact, about when teams are struggling and people look at the various factors involved. A lot of times there's a toxic dynamic on that team, whether it's one superstar doesn't get along with another, or whether it's the team is rather fractured, you know, and there's these cliques of people and people don't really like each other, or, you know, the coach, the GM is not fostering a, you know, a quote team environment. I mean, those explanations are acceptable and make sense to most people. So it doesn't really surprise me.
Well, right. And as it shouldn't. And another, you know, element of psychological and neuroscientific research that definitely is not known in the general world is how we can transmit emotion person to person, how sensitive we are to the emotions of the people around us. So, like, our brains are built to be cognizant of, you know, how other people are feeling around us. And we can't stop it. I mean, we can't turn it off. So, you know, if you have friction between two players, you know, if you have a superstar, you know, and a newbie, the feelings those people have are actually being communicated between them, even if they never say anything. Or even if they say all the proper words to each other, but it's not how they really feel.
Oh, absolutely.
We pick up on the feelings, and then picking up on the feelings. I mean, you know, if you're the new guy, you know, on the team with the superstar, and you know you're out there, and he passes to you, and you don't get the pass. You know, you're not only upset about not getting the pass, you're upset about disappointing him. He's mad at you. You know, then that makes you more paranoid, and then you're not allowed to actually be afraid. And then what's going to happen the next time? And then, you know, you get fouled and you have to go to the line. You know, your odds of making it are really way below whatever your free throw average is.
I love that you brought that point up, because that absolutely is correct, whether people want to admit it or not. And there's plenty of scientific research showing, you know, research on intuition, which is basically what you know, we read in your bio in the beginning, intuiting, feeling, which is really a crucial element. And quite honestly, I think that the best, the greatest players, team players, actually not even on a team, could be relative to individual sports as well, but the greatest athletes are able to tap in to the intuitive side of themselves in order to strategically gain an advantage, because you can use that to your advantage as well, not just within your own team, right? But if you're playing another team and that other team has some sort of friction or fractured dynamic, and you're smart enough to be able to pick up on the emotions and the feelings that are unspoken,
right,
that are going on that other team, well, you can just take advantage because that's a weakness. So
right.
I think that the smartest people get that for sure.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
And some of them might not even do it on purpose, I would think. Some people, it just kind of comes to you innately. They may not ever verbalize it or think about it, but they could be picking up on that, right?
Oh, yeah. It wouldn't necessarily be conscious, is what you're saying. And yes. I mean, I think, you know, if you take my basketball days, the Michael Jordan days, Michael Jordan could pick up on that kind of thing consciously.
Yeah.
And use it consciously, and it was pretty much obvious to everyone who was watching that he was using it consciously.
Absolutely.
You know, while everyone stood there with their jaws on the floor. How did he do that? But chances are many more professional athletes use that than we know.
I would expect. It's all part of the holistic package. Well, this has been amazing, Denise. And before I let you go, I always ask our guests to leave us with something from their personal toolkit. So just some recommendations for folks who are listening who are more than likely not professional athletes, whether you play a sport outside of work or whether you trade on your own or, you know, really any of this is actually just applicable to life in general. So if you have any tips that you'd like to leave people with, whether it's things to read, things to do, exercises, anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, the tip actually is going to be this, the tip I talked about before. But so whenever you're in a situation where the pressure's on, whether it be, you know, the putt, the free throw, you know, you've got the puck in hockey. It is a puck, right?
Puck, yeah.
I've been to a few hockey games in my life. Yeah. Whenever that pressure's on and you're going through some mental gyrations about what's going to happen, allow yourself to say, I'm nervous. Allow yourself to say, I'm worried. Allow yourself to say, I'm embarrassed. I won't, you know, I'm afraid I'll be embarrassed. Whatever the feeling is, if you allow yourself to say it, and in the process of saying it, actually physically experience it, you're physically experiencing it, you're just not knowing it, but if you let yourself physically, like, feel the anxiety for a second, I essentially guarantee over time, if you use that, your performance will go up.
I love it. A guarantee from Denise Schull. we'll certainly ask people how that worked for them and give you the feedback. This has been really, really, really great. And now when I watch the playoffs for the next couple of weeks, I am going to be scrutinizing people's faces to see who shows emotion and who doesn't, and then see if it correlates to the wins. Denise, thank you so much. And remember, everybody, for more information, you can check out her work on her company's website. That's www.therethinkgroup.net. That's therethinkgroup.net. Her book, which is a really fantastic book, I've read it. It's called Market Mind Games, A Radical Psychology of Investing, Trading, and Risk. For anyone who's interested in that or just in the psychology behind it, you could check that out. You can get it at Amazon or any bookstore. And you can also follow her on Twitter at Denise K. Schull, S-H-U-L-L. And I'm sure she'll reply to your tweets. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Remember to drop us a line at likeanathlete@cbsi.com with questions or ideas for future shows. We'll feature them. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Erin Schroney. Ask any questions. And, of course, subscribe. Please subscribe to our podcast on the iTunes Store. And we will love you forever. Thanks again to our guest, Denise Schull. And we'll catch you guys next week.